Morning, everybody. For our visitors, our regular minister, as you may have heard, is out of town spoiling grandkids. So I do appreciate all the prayers on his behalf that he will come back safely, very much. But Denise says the speaker that you usually have while he's gone must be better because I never doze off whenever Russ is out of town during the sermon, so that's got to count for something, right? I'd like to speak to you for a few minutes this morning about grace, something we sometimes talk about, we hear about it a lot. I'd like to start off with, what is grace? What does it mean? For some people, it's just what you say before a meal, something we sing about, you know, with amazing grace and things like that. There's a saying that says there, but for the grace of God go I. So, you know, it's something we hope we have, I guess. But grace is undeserved favor. It's something we get that we haven't earned, that we don't deserve. We feel like we deserve lots of things in life. You look around at the things you have and like, I have this because I earned this. You know, I deserve this. I worked hard. You know, I followed all the rules, I did things right, and now I have things. So I got what I deserve. Sometimes we think we even deserve things that we don't have. You know, I deserve to get that raise. I deserve to get that promotion. I deserve to have a nicer car. There's all kind of things that we think we deserve. And sometimes it's hard for us to deal with getting things that we don't deserve. Sometimes that's a little bit harder to deal with. There's three important features of grace that I'd like to talk about today. And to illustrate the first one, I'd like to tell you a little story about the mayor of New York City, Mayor LaGuardia, back during the Depression and World War II. He was a very colorful character, in case you're wondering why he deserves to have an airport named after him. He was... not the usual kind of politician you picture today. You know, most of the time we have presidents that are tall and everything. Kids' class today, we learned that King Saul was a foot taller than everybody else. Usually think of that. He was 5 foot four. LaGuardia, not Saul. 5 foot four. He wasn't a tall man, but he was very colorful. This was a difficult time to be mayor of New York City, and so he made his presence known throughout the city. He used to ride around on the fire trucks with the firefighters, and he'd go with the police department and raid the speakeasies and shut those down. And he was known to take an entire orphanage out to a ball game. Whenever the newspapers were on strike, he got on the radio and he would read the comics to the kids. He was a very interesting person. And so one night was a cold night, January 1935. He showed up in a night court, gave the judge the night off, and he sat there and held court for the judge that night. There was a lady wearing old tattered clothes that was brought before him, and she'd been accused of stealing a loaf of bread. And so he asked her, you know, why'd you steal the bread? And she says that her husband had deserted her, and her daughter was sick, and her grandkids were starving, and so that's why she stole the loaf of bread. So Mayor LaGuardia turned to the shopkeeper and asked, you know, well, you know, under the circumstances, do you want to drop the charges? And he said, this is a bad neighborhood. There's a lot of stealing going on, and she needs to be taught a lesson. So he says, no, I'm not going to drop the charges. So LaGuardia said, well, you know, I've got to punish you. The law says that you've done wrong, and it doesn't make any exceptions. So fine is $10 or 10 days in jail. He knew she didn't have $10. So while he's saying that, he reaches into his pocket and pulls out the $10 for the fine. So he pays her fine for her. And then he turns around to the courtroom. You know, they're all pleased to see what he's done. And he said, I'm fining each of you 50 cents for living in a city where a lady has to steal a loaf of bread. So, he went around, sent the bailiff out, told him to collect the fines, and then he said to give all of those to the defendant. So, the newspapers reported the next day that not only had she had her fine paid for her, but that $47.50 was given over to her as a result of all of those fines. So, you know, there were a lot of people there that were very struck by that statement. In fact, he got a standing ovation from those very people that just had to pay 50 cents. You know, they felt like, you know, that was a very nice thing to do. So, did she get what she deserved? You know, she'd stolen a loaf of bread. She had a reason, but, you know, stealing is stealing. It's still theft, and she deserved punishment because she did break the law, but it's a story about grace. That's whenever somebody in a higher position shows kindness to somebody in a lower position, and kindness that they hadn't earned, that they hadn't deserved. They showed mercy. And so that's what happened in there. You know, he paid the fine. He turned over the money that was collected. This was grace, something that she hadn't deserved. And so that's the first point that I want to make. Grace is something you receive, not something you deserve. So I want to bring your mind back to the story that was read to you earlier. This is a story a lot of times we kind of have a problem with. You know, if we were writing the Bible, we might not would have put this story in the Bible because it's not fair. And so that's a little hard for us to deal with. You know, some of these workers were hired in the morning and they worked all day, and some of them were hired a little time into the day, they're noon, and then some of them are hired just an hour before quitting time, and then they all get paid the same. And the whole point of the story is, well, you know, who hired the workers? It was the landowner, and did they have to take the job? It was their choice. They could choose to work or not work. He said he'd pay them what was right. That was what he promised. A denarius was a day's wages then, so, you know, they got paid what they should have gotten. So was it fair that the ones at the end of the day got paid the same? No, it wasn't. It wasn't fair. And that's kind of why we sometimes have a problem with this story, is it's like, why is there a story in the Bible where somebody is just completely unfair? That doesn't seem right. But the story isn't about fairness. That's not why it was in there. It's not the lesson it was trying to teach. It's trying to teach a lesson about grace, that the landowner had the right to do as he chose, and he chose to pay the people at the end of the day the same amount as the earlier ones. He didn't take anything away from those hired at the beginning of the day. He said, you agreed to work a day for a denarius. That's what you got. Why are you unhappy? But it just didn't seem fair to them. So, you know, as we look through the Bible looking for examples of mercy or grace, it's not hard to find them. There's a lot of stories in there. We could talk about Paul. You know, he was personally called by Jesus, even though he'd been persecuting Christians. You know, he received grace, not anything he deserved. The classic examples, the thief on the cross. He got mercy for defending Jesus to the other thief. But I got a different example. So if you'll take your Bibles, quickly open them up and turn to the story of Mephibosheth. What's the matter? I should hear pages turning, right? And people quickly turn into that well-known story about Mephibosheth. Not a character that we really hear about too often in the Bible. He wasn't a king. He wasn't a prophet. He wasn't an apostle. He was a cripple. That was his claim to fame, was he was crippled. The story kind of starts in 1 Samuel chapter 20. not with Mephibosheth, but with David and Jonathan. You might remember this famous story where David is convinced that Saul wants to kill him. Jonathan's like, no way, my father couldn't possibly want to kill you. But just to be sure, I'll go find out and I'll help you escape if he is going to try to kill you. And that day, Jonathan had one condition. He's like, you know, if I'm going to, in a sense, betray my father here, he has a request. Because this is going to change Jonathan's life if he betrays his father, the king. 1 Samuel chapter 20, verse 14, Jonathan says, "But show me unfailing kindness like that of the Lord as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth." So, we all remember, Saul was trying to kill David. So Jonathan helps David escape. And later on, David becomes king. And he remembered his promise. He remembered his promise to Jonathan. So he turns to his servant in 2 Samuel chapter 9, verse 3. And David says, "Is there no one still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness?" And the servant answered the king, "There's still a son of Jonathan. He's crippled in both feet." And what had happened was whenever David became king, all of Saul's family decided to leave the country. Not to go on a pleasure trip or anything, but the tradition was back then when you became king, you killed all the members of the other king's family, so that there were no other people who could claim the throne from you. And so that was just kind of part of the way things worked back then. So all of Saul's family, when David became king, they didn't know he didn't plan that, so they snatched everything up and left the country in a big hurry. So much so that when the nurse snatched up Mephibosheth, who was a small child at the time, they dropped him. And so he ended up being crippled for the rest of his life because he was dropped whenever they were trying to escape. So, whenever David asked about that, the servant says, "Yeah, there's Mephibosheth. He's still around." So in 2 Samuel 9:6, we read, "When Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. David said, 'Mephibosheth.' 'Your servant,' he replied. 'Don't be afraid,' David said to him, 'for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table.' Mephibosheth bowed down and said, 'What is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me?' Then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, 'I've given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him and bring in the crops so that your master's grandson may be provided for. And Mephibosheth, grandson of your master, will always eat at my table.' Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, 'Your servant will do whatever my lord the king commands his servant to do.' So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah, and all the members of Ziba's household were servants of Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table, and he was crippled in both feet." Every time it talks about Mephibosheth in the Bible, it always talks about him in terms of his disability. That's how he's always described. What had Mephibosheth done to deserve any kind of favor from the king? He hadn't done anything. He was just Jonathan's son. That was his only claim to fame. And yet, he was given the chance to eat at the king's table. And think what this means. You know, who else ate at that table? This is where Solomon ate, you know, the wisest man that ever lived. Amnon and Tamar, Absalom, you know, with his long, beautiful, flowing hair. Joab, his military commander, you know, all bronzed and muscular and everything, is sitting there. All of these people sitting around this table, and there's Mephibosheth. So you can just picture him thinking, you know, "I don't deserve to be here. This is not the kind of place that somebody like me that anybody would expect to see them here. So he understood grace. He understood getting something that you hadn't done anything to deserve. So first point is grace is received, not deserved. And the second one, God's grace is about mercy. It's not about fairness. As in the story, it's not about getting what you deserve. It's about getting what you don't deserve. The people that were hired at the end of the day got a wage that they didn't deserve. Mephibosheth got something he didn't deserve. Because it was all about grace. There's one last feature about grace that I wanted to talk about. I'm sure that some of you, at least the ones who are a little bit older, remember a guy named Jeffrey Dahmer. That's one of those names that will go down in infamy. He murdered 17 men and boys between 1978 and 1991. He preserved and ate a lot of their body parts. It was pretty bad. He was convicted, sent to prison. After serving less than 3 years of a sentence, he was beaten to death in prison. And a lot of people felt like he got what he deserved whenever he was beaten to death in prison after all of the horrible things that he'd done in life. But about 6 months before he was killed, he was baptized after he studied the Bible with a Church of Christ minister named Roy Ratcliffe. Not Radcliffe, but Ratcliffe. Different family. He met with him once a week, and all the way up until the week that he was killed in prison. The minister got to know him very well. He wrote a book about him. It's called Dark Journey, Deep Grace, about Jeffrey Dahmer's experience that he had there. After he became a Christian, not everybody really thought the conversion was sincere or that his faith was real, and it angered a lot of people. In fact, there was somebody from Roy Ratcliffe's own congregation that said, if Jeffrey Dahmer is going to heaven, then I don't want to be there. So, was Jeffrey Dahmer saved? I don't know. We can't know that. God knows. The psychiatrist that examined him testified that it was a longing for companionship that caused Dahmer to kill. He stated, Mr. Dahmer is not psychotic. Spoke kindly of Jeff, describing him as amiable, pleasant to be with, courteous, with a sense of humor, conventionally handsome and charming in manner. He was and still is a bright young man. This is how the psychiatrist described him. He was found sane to stand trial. He obviously had some mental disorders. I think that much is clear. But, suppose for a moment he was sane, not only at the time he committed his crimes, but that he had a sincere conversion. That's a little hard for some of us to deal with. But he's one of those people that was perhaps hired at the 11th hour. And it's one thing to say, you got the same amount of money here, but he may be receiving the same reward that we're expecting. So, the last point, the first one is grace is received, not deserved. God's grace is about mercy, not fairness. And the last point, God's grace is for the last as well as the first. So, there's a lot of people that we look at and we say, it's not fair that they should get to go to heaven. Somebody that lives a horrible life and then right at the end of their life, they're converted and they're baptized, and now after living their life any way they wanted to in open rebellion to God, now then they're going to go to heaven. And it just doesn't seem right. They don't deserve to be there. They don't deserve to be there. You deserve to be there. If we're going to do this heaven thing on a qualification basis, it's going to be a pretty empty place. None of us deserve to be there. If suppose we had a contest here We're going to see who can jump all the way up to the moon. Us old guys, we jump, we manage to clear about 6 inches, and some of the young guys, maybe Brandon, can jump a foot and a half in the air. And so Brandon goes around bragging, "I got so much closer to the moon than you did." It's really nothing to brag about that much. He still was quite a long way from making it to the goal. And that's the way we are with heaven. We're a long way from being there. So if we're going to compare ourselves to other people, then that's a false comparison, because the only way that we can get there is through the grace of God. And God is the landowner. He sets the rules. He pays people what he thinks they deserve. The good thing is that God is fair. And we know that God knows whether somebody has a sincere conversion. He knows whether they've decided to be a follower. And that's what our upcoming lesson series is going to be about, is being a follower and not a fan. And since we've spent all this time talking about grace, that's the reward. That's what we're going for. That's the goal of being a follower and not a fan, is to have access to that grace. Because being a follower is tough. Being a fan is easy. I'm a Saints fan. I've never been to a game in person. I don't have a jersey or anything. I don't even have a t-shirt that says Saints on it. But I'm a fan because, I try to watch the game sometimes, and I'll check the scores if I didn't watch the game and make sure of how they're doing. It's kind of the way some of us are with religion, too. We'll show up when we can. We'll root for it. We don't have the t-shirt or anything, but we'll show up and we'll put in a good face, and we'll occasionally mention, I'll sometimes tell my classes at school I'm a Saints fan, so therefore it's not quite the same as the devoted follower. It's a big difference. Being a follower of Jesus means it may have some effects on how you live your life. That's the idea behind being a follower. This is a serious commitment. It could affect your job choices, how you spend your money, how you prioritize your time, your money, how you spend your life. It may affect your relationship with family and friends. This is a life choice that Jesus is asking you to make. And, he's asking you to be a follower, and Jesus told people that weren't willing to be followers, then you can go your way. I don't want fans. He says, you either need to be a follower or else go and do your own thing. But you've got a choice to make. And we have that same choice to make now. We're going to be having some studies starting 2 weeks from today on Sunday evenings, and starting next week on Sunday mornings. Going to start a series about being a follower, so I encourage you to be there. We've been previewing these lessons, and they're definitely a life-changing experience. They make you rethink everything about your life, and whether you're a fan or a follower. So I definitely encourage you to be there. And the reason why I gave this lesson is so that you know that even though being a follower is going to have demands, it's worth it. Because that's the only way we can get that grace of God that we're searching for. Being a fan is just not going to cut it. So if we want to enter heaven, we need to be that follower. So that's my question for you today. And it's the same question that's going to be asked up here a lot of different times over the next few weeks. It's, are you a fan or are you a follower? And that's something that each person individually needs to decide, because your life depends on it, and your soul depends on it. So as we sing this song in a few moments, you've got an opportunity to think about your choices, your priorities, whether you're going to have access to that mercy that's available to you. It's your choice if you want to become that follower and receive that mercy and grace. So if you realize that you thought you were a follower and you are really just a fan, you've got an opportunity not just this morning, but any time coming up to realize that that's the decision that you made. If you've never yet made that decision to become a follower, you've got that opportunity this morning as well. We can baptize you this morning and let you start on that journey of being a true follower of Jesus. So if you have any needs, I encourage you to come forward while we stand and sing the songs.